My TED
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. Start my time because I'm a talker. I am limited. Get going. So thank you so much for having me, Owen. Thank you for asking. It's always an honor to be asked to be anywhere because for a long time I was not really welcome anywhere. So I have a sobriety date. It's May 18, 2014. So last week, 9 years, which is absolutely amazing. When I got sober, I wanted 7 months. My first sponsor had 7 months, and I thought if I could get 7 months, I could maybe pull it together enough that I wouldn't be actively destroying my life and myself. It seemed a lofty goal at the time because I couldn't put together more than a couple of days by myself. So I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. It's funny because I grew up right in the middle of where I grew up because I was born in Danville and then moved to Lafayette when I was 10. So we're sort of like right there. We had chickens and we used to buy animal feed at the animal food feed store right down the street. And my doctor was right here. So it's just funny, it's still like home. I grew up in chaos. I was a child of the 70s and it was always just a disaster. My house was crazy. I was talking about it today. My mom was a drug addict and my dad was an alcoholic, and that's not why I'm an alcoholic. That is, I am an alcoholic because I was born an alcoholic. I believe it to be a disease. And I do believe that once I started that train rolling, there was no stopping it. But it did contribute to a lot of my issues that led to my drinking, because my family was such that children should not be a bother. You know, like, I don't have time for you, I don't deal with you, I just want you to leave me alone. And when your narrative is, so it's very interesting. My brother is not an alcoholic, and he thought we had a great childhood because we were totally left alone. We were, you know, don't bother us, there were rules, we didn't have to clean our rooms, like, it was nothing about, you know, it was just freedom. And I thought, oh, my parents don't love us, we are completely neglected. I am scared all the time. I have no one to count on. No one cares about me. You know, so I completely had a very different perception of my upbringing. And because of that, like, I was in fear a lot. I had a lot of fear. I thought that if someone didn't tell me before I went to bed, I'll see you in the morning, I would die in my sleep. So every night I would wait out for my mom to come home every night. And some nights she came home, some nights she didn't. But so I didn't sleep with this child. So I hated my life. I hated being me. I hated everything about everything. I was just, I thought that I was worthless and useless and no one loved me. And that is not what people told me. That is just what I heard. You know, that is what I thought was my truth. And so when I found alcohol, when I was a late bloomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking at 16. And that is one of the later drinking stories that I hear. And the first time I drank, I was really, really mad at someone. I was really angry. And anger was a good default emotion for me because of the state. You know, fear is hard to acknowledge, anxiety isn't fun, but anger is comfortable. It is feel, especially self-righteous anger, when someone does you wrong. And everyone was always doing me wrong because I was always looking for it. And so it was mad. And I drank, my friend picked up a case of Parmesan cheese. It was so bad. Oh gosh, it was so bad. And it's all sugar. So the hangover was intense. But what I loved about it was that I was just numb. You know, some people talk about drinking because they wanted to be more outgoing. They didn't feel comfortable socially. I never had that problem. What I wanted was just not to feel. I hated living in my skin. It was uncomfortable. I didn't know how to be emotional. I didn't know how to feel feelings. I didn't know how to do anything. I just wanted to escape. And I found it. I found that escape. And you know, by the time I was in my early 20s, I was drinking a lot. And my mom was diagnosed with cancer when I was 20. And I drank around that a lot. I was very guilty. I felt a lot of guilt because I thought she got cancer because I was a terrible person. And I don't acknowledge the self-centeredness of that statement. Because it was like all about me. But I honestly, like, I just felt guilty all the time. And I felt guilty that I was healthy and I hated living. And my mom was dying and loved life. And it was just unfair. Cancer is not the kind of disease that doesn't discern, but I felt like it was just so unfair. And so I drank and drank. There's still a lot of drugs, but I drank and I drank and I drank. And by the time my mom was at sort of the end of her journey, I was living in a residential hotel in the Tenderloin. And for a sweet kid who grew up in Lafayette, that is a very deep dive. But I thought it was like I deserved because I was a terrible person, no one loved me, I was useless, and I was burnless. And you know, I was so mad at everyone in my family because it was all their fault. You know, my mom, not her fault. She said I forgave her, but like was my dad's fault because he was unavailable when I was a child. He forgot to pick me up once when I was 12. Like these just stupid reasons. I was just so mad. I was just needed outlets. I was so mad at my brother because he was a terrible brother. And I was mad at the world because you all seemed to have it together and I did not. And so I drank around all that. And so I would basically over the next sort of period of my life, I would pull it together and then fall apart and then pull it together and then fall apart. And a lot of that had to do with my active addiction. I quit hard drugs when my mom died because it seemed like it wasn't serving me anymore. And so I thought that I was fine. I was an addict, not an alcoholic. And so I just basically. And he was worse than me. So mine wasn't that bad because he kept getting arrested and I have not been arrested yet. And so it's amazing how when you're living with someone who's really bad, how you just don't look quite so bad. And I could keep a job. I had a car. Like he had none of that. And finally got to the point where I just couldn't live. He was drinking himself to death and I couldn't watch it. I couldn't watch him die. And you know, I was thinking about it today. He died at 44 of this disease, 10 years after we separated. And that's what people like me have to look forward to, quite honestly, is an alcoholic death. And thank God I found the rooms before that happened. I got arrested. That was my turning point. I was a drunk driver. I hate to tell you, please don't judge me. Because I thought if I drank at bars, I wasn't an alcoholic because I was with people. And that does not make sense. But in my alcoholic mind, it was how I excused my behavior. Every day I'd go to work, still drunk. And I think I'm not gonna drink today. I'm not going to the bar today. I'm not going to the bar today. And by noon I was like, well, you can just stop and have one drink. And then by 5 o'clock that drink was inevitable. And what I realized today that I did not know then is I didn't have a choice. When I woke up in the morning and thought I am not going to drink, I was going to drink no matter what because I had lost the power to choose yes or no. It was always yes, always yes. And once I started, I would not stop until physically I could not put more in. So that morning, we had a work party the day that I got arrested. And I loved work parties because it was free booze. And I was set up because I could start drinking as soon as I started setting up, because that's when the party started. So like by maybe noon, I was drinking. And so by the time I left that party, I was 3 bottles of wine in. I was not doing my best. And I was thirsty. I needed a glass of water. That was what my thought was when I was in the car. I was like, I just need a glass of water. So I stopped at a bar because that's the only place you can get water, don't you know? And I was at the bar, and then I came to another bar arguing with a bartender. And I don't know why. I'm sure I had done something obnoxious because I am obnoxious. And as a drunk, I was mean obnoxious. And they kicked me out of the bar and saw me get in my car, and they called the police. And which was justified. I was not in any shape to drive. And I, believe me, I know how lucky I was that I didn't hurt anyone, because people did, and then people do. And so they arrested me. And my favorite quote of my arrest was, as they were handcuffing me, I said, "Do you really have to handcuff me? I'm from Lafayette." And, so the arrest did not go well. I don't know if you've ever been arrested, but it's not great fun. And I was not in my right mind at the time, and they ended up 5150ing me. And the most dreamy EMT came and picked me up. And that's like what I remember about the whole thing. I still have the blanket he gave me in my car. It's dreamy, but because I want that constant reminder of that night. I never want to forget what that felt like that night. And I never want to forget what it felt like that morning, waking up on a cot in the emergency room of the mental hospital. It was not a good feeling. It was not. And so I called my friend, Jennifer, who I've known since I was 12. And she was my one phone call that night. We've been friends for, at that point, 25 years. And she woke up in the morning to this message saying, you know, "We have your friend. She's been arrested. If you pick her up, we won't take her to jail." This is before the 5150. And she spent the entire day trying to find me, because they won't tell you a person where they take someone when they've been arrested if they're, you know, if they're not there. So they couldn't say, "Oh, we've sent her to the mental hospital. She'll call you when she gets out." So she went to my work. She went to my house. She climbed over my balcony and knocked on my window, thinking maybe I just was out and couldn't hear her. And she was frantic. And I got out of the mental hospital. And, 4 o'clock the next day. And I charged my phone. They parked my car. They were very kind because I'm from Lafayette. And I get in my car and I plug my phone in, and I see that there's like 50 messages from my sweet friend. And I call her as I'm driving home. I'm like, "Oh, this is my typical behavior." And she's like, "I'm on my way to your house." And she showed up at my house. She had a tea and a muffin she had bought for me while she was trying to find me. And she was devastated. And I was like, I couldn't have cared less. I'm not going to lie. And it's not because I knew it wasn't a big deal. I was like, aware it was like a bad thing. But I was like, "Oh, whatever. It's kind of what I, you know, just me." And she cried. And I had never seen her cry. I had, in all our years of friendship, I'd never seen her cry. And I looked at myself with her eyes in that moment. And I was like, "Oh, no, I'm hurting other people." And I didn't realize that, because I thought, okay, I was thinking on it today, and it's not that I didn't care about other people. I just didn't know they cared about me. And so I thought I was only hurting myself. And I realized in that moment that wasn't true. And I was like, "Oh God, I gotta get help." And, you know, in my life, I've had moments of grace. And that was my first moment of grace, where God's light shone into my heart. And I saw myself through someone else's eyes. And I realized that I was hurting someone that I loved desperately. And so that was enough. And I called and I got into treatment. And I thought that would be enough to keep me sober, but it wasn't, because I drank again. I got drunk, real, real drunk at it, because I was mad. And I hadn't been going to AA at this point. I'd just been doing the treatment. And they taught me a lot about the neurotransmitters and the chemical dependency and sort of the medical stuff, because I was going to Kaiser and some medical, and it's a medical model. And it was great educationally, but I didn't know how to feel feelings. So how am I supposed to stay sober around a feeling? Like, I didn't know. So I got drunk as soon as I had a feeling. And a negative feeling, I should say. Although the positive ones were fun to drink around too. But And my last drink was at a wedding. I mean, yeah, wedding at Bound Rio, which is, it's funny because I'm doing the golf scramble this year and it's at Bound Rio. And every time I go and volunteer there, I'm always like, and it was nothing. It was like so insignificant. And I was getting drunk, which was really a bummer. But I was drinking gin because I hate gin. And I thought if I drink gin, I won't drink as much. It's not how it works if you're an alcoholic. After the first drink, it honestly doesn't matter what you're drinking. And so I had brought a sober date because you're supposed to do that, but he was on meth. And so that didn't work as good as I thought it might. And I drove him home like halfway through the wedding. And I sat in my car and I realized that I didn't remember anything about the wedding. Like I just left the wedding. I couldn't tell you what the decorations were, who sat at my table, what they served for food, but I could tell you everything about the alcohol. And I knew in that moment I was an alcoholic because I cannot start drinking and not go to the end. It's never like I'll have a drink and then be like, oh, that was casual. Like it's never casual for me. And I realized in that moment that as soon as I put any intoxicant in my body, I will not stop. I am completely unmanageable and I'm super powerless. And so I knew that I needed more help than I was getting through my treatment. And I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was tough. The first year of my sobriety was tough. Not just because the obsession to drink wasn't lifted immediately for me. It took a long time, but I also made a lot of really bad decisions because I still hated myself. That didn't go away just because I got sober instantly. So I made a lot of decisions based on self that were not good for me, but I stayed sober around all of it. That was the only thing I did right my first year of sobriety is that I didn't drink no matter what, because I knew as soon as my eyes were open to the damage I was doing to myself and to others, I knew I couldn't drink anymore. I knew it was over. And I was still really mad at a lot of people. That was harder for me to get over. I was mad because my dad and my stepmom just didn't understand. And then they weren't available emotionally and they are self-centered in their own ways. And, you know, because they're people. Go figure, they're people and they're doing their best. And I couldn't see any of that because all I could see was my side. And it wasn't that I wanted to hurt them. It's not that I wanted to be a bad daughter or a bad sister. It's just, I didn't know how to be a good one. I didn't know how. And so, honestly, the steps helped me learn to live with myself. And it taught me, so I got to the 12 step. I worked the steps with a sponsor. She was the one who had 7 months. And that was my goal, was to get what Carla had because she seemed pretty campy. And I got to the 12 step and I hopped. And it was the only step I tripped over. And as soon as she said, okay, we're on the 12th step, you have to start reaching out to others. You have to start sponsoring women. You have to start doing what we do. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And it wasn't because I thought I was like special and didn't need to do it. What I thought was I was so broken and I had nothing to give. What am I going to offer anyone in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? I have nothing. I have no wisdom. I have no, emotional sobriety. Like I was a mess. I was a mess. And I still wanted to drink. So like, how am I supposed to tell people this works? I didn't want to drink. I don't, but I want to. And so I stopped talking to my sponsor. I was like, this is my solution. And so after like a couple months of not talking to my sponsor, I'm still going to meetings, but I started to get self-sponsorship is a bad idea. And a crazy mind trying to help and heal a crazy mind is not a good idea either.
Can you let me know the session dates? Individual sessions with Tony.
So I called my sponsor. She said, well, you have to start reaching out to women. You have to start sponsoring people. You have to start raising your hand that you're available. And I was like, but she's like, no one will ask you. She's like, no one wants what you got. And she didn't say that. She was far too kind. But that's what I figured. I was like, no one's going to ask me to sponsor them. And this first time I raised my hand, a woman came up and was like, will you sponsor me? I was like, And she was a physicist. She worked at NASA or something. And I was like, oh my good gravy. It's like a super genius. And she's like, you can barely read, you're an idiot. And so broken. I was so broken still. But the thing is that as soon as I started just reaching my hand out to newcomers and saying, well, we're happy you're here, please come back. That's all I had to do. And then read a book with another woman. You know, I didn't have to invent sponsorship. It's in there, black and white. I just have to read the book. Every now and again, say, do you identify? You know, I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's a pretty low ball. And so I finished the steps with my, started working the 12 step, and then I started working all the steps in my life. And, you know, some more than other at times. And maybe about the year mark, I was living my day, doing my thing. And I was like, no, I haven't been angry in a while. And I haven't been so anxious, like just constantly. I was like, I just feel like someone let the air out. I always felt like a shook up soda bomb, you know, that tension. And I just didn't feel that in that moment. And I didn't feel great. I wasn't like walking on sunshine, but I just didn't feel terrible. And I was like, oh, that's it. That's the miracle. That's the miracle. I could live in my skin. And once that happened, the desire to drink was lifted. And I haven't had it since. I mean, that, you know, it's been quite a few years, quite a few days. And so my ability to be in my family, be a person among people, really came when I started working in traditions. Because I was the only one who suffered. I don't know, like in my brain that other people feel sad. You know, people feel emotions, but I was like, no, not like me. And my mom, when I was 12, when I told her that, I was like, I think I feel things differently than most people. She's like, you're a drama queen. And I was. But at the same time, I just didn't realize that everyone had the same sort of depth to their feelings. So I thought that, like, no one knows what it is to suffer like me. And so because of that, I didn't treat people very well. I didn't think about my actions or my consequences. I was really angry. And so I acted as such. I was mean to my family. I was mean to my brother. I would always say, I will be there. And then I would not show up. Because I knew if I said no, I'd have to give an explanation. You know, they'd be like, well, why can't you come to your grandpa's 80th birthday? And I have to find an excuse and lie. So I'd be like, oh, I will absolutely be there. This is a true story. And then I stayed up all night doing drugs and thought, I can't go to my grandma's 80th birthday. And I didn't. And they missed me. I mean, I don't know why. It's not my best self. But still, like, you know, I'm their granddaughter. I'm their daughter. I'm their sister. I'm their friend. I'm a person. I'm in the family. And I just blew it off. I didn't even call. I didn't even tell anyone why I wasn't there. I just ignored phone calls. And I thought, and it's not like I am a bad person. I'm not, I really want to be a good person, but I just didn't know how. I didn't know how to care about other people. And so, when you're drinking and using like that, it's like the world just gets small. It just gets so small, and all I thought about was me and my suffering and my sadness and my troubles and my worries. And, you know, I just didn't see, when I was living in the Tenderloin, my parents showed up, my dad and my stepmom, they showed up and said, please, will you see us? And I was like, fine, so I'm so generous. And they gave me a phone. This was must've been about 2000. So it wasn't as common, you know, not everyone had a cell phone, and I didn't, because I couldn't afford one. I was living in a hotel. And they gave me a phone and they said, please just answer it sometimes when we call. Hmm. Like, how sad is that? They did not know. Like, I mean, they saw where I was living. They saw what my life looked like, and they just wanted to know I was alive every now and again. And I didn't care. I was like, whatever. It's like hard to describe because, of course, I love my parents. I love them always. But I just was like, I don't care if I live or die. Why would you? And so I talked to my dad today. I call him all the time, probably more than he likes. But I want them, number one, to know I'm okay every day. You know, I want them to not have to carry that burden anymore because they carried it. And that's heavy. I can only imagine what it's like to love someone like I love my niece and nephew, or like I love my family, like, and not know if they're alive or if they're suffering or if, you know, they're in jail. You know, I mean, I can never, ever make up for what I did to them, to their hearts. But I work every day to do so. You know, I live a life now, they don't have to worry as much. I'm still waiting. But you know, and so I call them very frequently. My stepmom has cancer. So I was calling every day for a while. And they're like, you don't have to call every day. Okay. You know, but I worry now. I care. And it's so magical. The biggest transformation though of my sobriety and my relationships with my family is me and my brother. I was so mad at him because I felt like he abandoned our family. Because he had to do what he had to do for his own. Like I said, we grew up in chaos and he had to leave. And I was so mad at him over it. I was so angry. And I took a lot. If I drank around him, he would be the exact, like all of my focused anger would be on him. And I said terrible things to him and I treated him very poorly. And it took him years to forgive me, years. And he, you know, he would tolerate me, you know, he would let me around, but he would bring it up a lot. Remember that time you said, remember that time you did, remember when you called me, remember when you said this? And I was like, yes, at 5 years sober, I was like, okay, let's not bring it up anymore. I get that I did all those things, but I'm really trying. And it's hard for me to move past it if we can't move past it. And I deserved it. I was just in that moment. I was like, I can't hear anymore about what a terrible person I am. Because I'm trying so hard. I'm trying so hard. And today, he's probably my best friend. And I love him. I don't know what I would do without him. I don't know. He and I tomorrow, we have a sick relative and we're driving down to LA together. And I spent the whole week dealing with this, the sort of putting this together, you know, talking to family, talking to my relatives, you know, sort of deciding when we're going to leave, whatever. And I did it all. And I would just call them and update them. Okay, we're going to do this. We're going to leave here. We're going to go here. We're going to see these people, you know, just sort of, I arranged it all, which is not what I would do. Like, I don't want to do any of that. I want to not deal with any bad stuff. But I suit up and I show up. I suit up and I show up for my family. And he's like, the person we're going to see is she's a difficult woman on her best day. And he's like, well, do we have to go? And I said, absolutely, we have to go. I said, not just to see her, but to support our other family members who are suffering because of this sickness. You know, it's not just us. It's not just her. It's a community. And we need to be there for our community, for our people. And that is Alcoholics Anonymous. That is what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. It has made me suit up and show up when I don't want to. It has made me make hard decisions and do tough things and be there when I don't want to be there. And I'm so grateful for that because my life is so full of love and laughter and fun and people and community and fellowship. And I was utterly alone. When I walked into these rooms, utterly alone. At least I felt them. I didn't see that I was given love. I didn't see that people wanted to be there for me and I was just keeping everyone at arm's length. And now I, you know, when you welcome in that sort of circle, you welcome in some suffering and sadness and loss, but it's all worth it. The full scope of emotions is absolutely worth it. I wasn't just drinking and blocking out the bad, I was drinking and blocking out the good. And I did not see that. I want to say thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. I'm so grateful to be here and share my message. And I hope that, I don't know, it's we're sick people all trying to be well. And I'm so thankful that I get to try and be well every day. So thank you so much.